Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikulskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is author Scott Turow, who first took us to that fictional Midwestern location of Kendall County with his 1987 debut novel, Presumed Innocent. He's now out with the latest thriller in that series. It's called The Last Trial, where a now 85-year-old Sandy Stern is closing out his half-century legal career by representing a longtime friend accused of murder and several white-collar crimes. Scott, traditionally, being a trial lawyer is a young man's game. What keeps Sandy Stern motivated to keep trying cases into his mid-80s?
Well, as he thinks to himself at one point, this is what he needed to do in order to fully know himself. And it's not only the only thing he knows how to do well, it's also been incredibly fulfilling to him, although he can't quite explain why.
The defendant in this case, Dr. Pafko, charged with racketeering, insider trading, murder. Usually when you see those type of charges, it's against a mafioso, a Whitey Bulger type. Dr. Pafko is not a mafia type. So what's going on here?
Well, Dr. Pafko is a Nobel Prize winner in medicine who has created a successful cancer medication called Gelivia. The problem is that in addition to prolonging many people's lives, Gelivia, after about a year of use, also kills a certain number of people from an acute allergic reaction. And the government believes Dr. Pafko knew that very well and hid the information from the FDA so that the drug could get approved for the market. And then when reporters began to tumble to the fact that there were lethal side effects, Pafko dumped about $20 million worth of stock in the company before the Wall Street Journal could print the information. So that's why he's in all this hot water. The prosecutor believes that he let people die, in order to get his drug approved and make more money and have his name, blazing through the stars yet again.
What kind of tactical advantage exists for the government by throwing in some murder charges in a case like this, which is basically a white-collar case?
Well, the last trial explains this in detail, and I hope these kinds of nuances of the trial of criminal cases appeal to readers. But the advantage of charging murder is that the prosecutors get to prove that people actually died. In other words, if they limited themselves to the usual repertoire of federal charges, they would be able to prove that there were reports of these side effects and that the agency should have known about them. But the actual fact that people had died after taking this medication would not have been properly admitted in evidence. So by charging Pafko with murder, the prosecutors believe they can bring home the ultimate gravity of this crime to the jury.
As I said in the introduction, Sandy Stern is representing his friend. What kind of issues arise when a lawyer decides to represent a longtime friend who's accused of a crime?
Well, Stern, who practices law with his daughter, Marta, is very excited to be, called back to the battlefield in a case that's going to have national impact and publicity. And he goes in to tell his daughter, and she looks at him and says, Dad, don't you understand the reason he wants to be represented by a friend is so he can lie to him. He wants a lawyer who won't challenge some of his obvious falsehoods. And the conflict between maintaining a personal relationship and assuming a professional role, can be severe at times. And, Stern disregards his daughter's advice and halfway through the trial realizes there was more to it than he recognized at first.
A lot of the story is told through trial testimony. And as a writer, what do you have to keep in mind as you're writing trial dialogue as opposed to dialogue that, like human beings, talk outside of a courtroom?
For those of us who have tried a lot of lawsuits, and I started my life as a federal prosecutor and then went into private practice and tried, many, many cases there. It frankly, Brian, is second nature. But obviously people on the witness stand choose their words more carefully they're less colloquial and often pretty stilted in what they have to say. And so you have to follow the familiar patterns for trial witnesses.
There's a lot of introspective moments in this book with the characters about relationships between parents and children. And as you wrote the story, how much did you realize that those relationships affected how the people, Sandy included, chose to live his life?
I think I realized that, from the inception, having lived my own life, I just wanted to bring home how full but complex this good man's life is. And, he's had successes in his personal relationships, like his relationship with his daughter, which for all the bumps and warts is really an intense bond. And he's had failures, as he judges his own first marriage, where his wife died by her own hand. So it's a complicated world that Sandy is moving through, and the personal relationships are very much with him as he tries, Kirill Pafko's case, and tries to keep him out of prison.
I'm chatting with Scott Turow about his brand new book, The Last Trial. It's the latest in the Kindle County series. Something I've noticed, Scott, about your Kindle County books, reading them over the years, you didn't do this for Presumed Innocent and The Burden of Proof, but I think you've done it for every book since, is the chapters all have names. And I don't see that in a lot of novels or thrillers. Why do you choose to do that?
What a great observant question. I think it's a second chance to direct the readers the same way that a title does. And it, orients them in space and time. Often, as you point out in a book like this, there's a lot of retrospection going on. Stern is looking backwards. And so I like to remind the readers where we are in the story and, what's about to happen. It's as simple as that. It's just taking them by the hand a little bit.
When Kindle County was created for Presumed Innocent, and you said you originally wanted to set that in Boston, but the story was better suited for a Chicago-like Midwestern city, what led you about Presumed Innocent and Kindle County to that conclusion?
I wrote Presumed Innocent, most of it, while I was serving as an assistant U.S. attorney in Chicago. And it's a really demanding job, as I'm sure people recognize. And the time I had was limited to usually 30 minutes on the morning commuter train. And as a result, it took me close to 8 years to finish the manuscript. And over those 8 years, I do not keep a personal diary. So what I am observing that I want to write down gets pumped into the writing of the fiction. And so what started out as Boston, and you can still see signs of it in Kindle County, ended up looking a lot more like Chicago. And I hadn't been self-conscious about creating this imaginary landscape, but by the time I'd finished a draft, I didn't want to relocate things to Chicago because it fit the profile of a somewhat smaller city, but with a complex political and ethnic life, and I just Kindle County was where I'd settled, and then when I decided to write my second novel about Sandy Stern, who'd been Rusty Savage's defense lawyer and Presumed Innocent, played, people may remember, by the great Raul Julia. Stern had been a defense lawyer in Kindle County, so I continued in Kindle County, and pretty soon I was, situated in this imaginary place that whose location I know.
Are you ever creatively limited by the fact that it's not in Boston or not in New York and it's actually in Kindle County?
Well, one of the things I thought I was gaining when I started writing about Kindle County is I was freed from the need to figure out and recall things like, do Adams and Madison in Chicago, do they run east or do they run west? I thought I would avoid the obvious answers. 12 novels in, though, Kindle County has been pretty fully described, and I end up having to look back at the earlier books so I don't make the same kinds of mistakes that I thought I was free to avoid originally, you know, which is where does the courthouse stand in relation to other buildings in town, and is it east or west in the center city, and where is the you know, US 843, which is the highway, where does that stand vis-a-vis everything else? So I built myself the same box I was trying to get out of.
I'm sure not a lawyer has gone to law school without reading 1L and your book about your first year at Harvard Law School. Are you surprised how relevant that book has stayed over the years?
Yes. You know, I went back to Harvard to sort of commemorate the 40th anniversary of the book. And but it was really interesting to me. The 1L, the first-year law students, were in their third week in school, and no matter how different law school instruction is in some ways, people were every bit as anxious as I had been. And I remember a young man I'd met in Chicago and talked with about law school. He came sort of panting up to me to apologize that he wasn't going to be able to go to my presentation because he had a paper due in his moot court class, and he was a 1L through and through. And I think that the anxiety in particular of the kind of identity crisis that the first year in law school produces has ended up being pretty persistent. And as I always like to joke, the advantage of reading 1L is that no matter how crazy you feel, you know that there was somebody even crazier than you who survived the experience.
Well, in 1L, Sandy Stern was an MIT engineer in your study group. Can I assume that was a pseudonym that you came up with and you liked the name so well you just kept it for this series?
You know, again, an unbelievably observant question. It turned out after I submitted the manuscript for Presumed Innocent, and Jonathan Galassi, who ended up as the publisher of Fair, Straus, and Giroux, had bought the manuscript, he went back and read 1L, and he said to me, "Did you know there was a character in 1L named Sandy Stern?" And I was like, "Oh, God, you know, I worked so hard on this name, and I thought it was perfect for the defense lawyer. Are you telling me I'm going to have to change the name?" And Jonathan laughed. He said, "No." He said, "Stick with it." He said, "Really observant readers over the years will ask you about it, but they're certainly intended to be two different people. And as you say, it's obvious that there was a certain music in the name that I, that really appealed to me. So I ended up using it twice, once as a pseudonym for a real person and once for an entirely fictional character that I had made up and presumed innocent and went forward with.
Well, and you mentioned Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. I think that was at the summer of 87 when Presumed Innocent and then Tom Wolfe's book came out, Bonfire of the Vanities, and that summer for that same publishing company?
Exactly. It was Fair Straus was a little literary publishing house known for publishing the books of various Nobel Prize winners and probably the best American publisher of poetry. But it was not a place where bestsellers were published. And when Presumed Innocent and then a few months later Bonfire of the Vanities both hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list, there was a lot of joking because it had been since 1964 that Fair Straus had had a number one bestseller. And I used to kid Jonathan about how Fair Straus was now the home of the number one bestsellers. But they used the money to repaint the place and refurnish, and they put in a health plan for the employees of the publishing house. So Tom and I did well by everybody at FSG.
And then I know it's crazy times we're in now, but you're a longtime handkerchief connoisseur. Is that product becoming harder to find these days?
I don't know if it's harder to find because I wrote a piece in the Washington Post that you're obviously referring to, and I've always carried a handkerchief in my back pocket, and I have dozens of them. And my kids thought this was quaint and extremely old-fashioned. And then, of course, it turns out to be a very useful object these days to have in your pocket if you want to grab a doorknob that you're a little self-conscious about touching, or if you sneeze, I know the CDC says try to sneeze into your elbow, but you got better aim than I have if you can do that successfully. So I think covering your mouth with a handkerchief is a more successful strategy. And all of this arose from my son, who sent me a text one morning and said, "Dad, this is an article you were born to write. Bring back the handkerchief." So I had the great satisfaction that parents always get about being able to look at their children and say, "I told you so."
Great story. All right, the book is The Last Trial. It's the latest in the Kendall County series from Scott Turow. Scott, just another excellent offering. I enjoyed it a lot, and thanks for joining me to talk about it.
Great. Thank you, Brian. I appreciate all the astute questions, too.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
I could have missed the pain, but I'd have had to miss the